Hey, welcome back to the intellectual bouncy house. Bouncy house? Known as the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are taking apart the rhetoric, sometimes putting it back together as something new, sometimes not. This is the show within the show. This is the Rhetorician Files, episode 15, 13 of them with D-Pain, who's once again our guest today.
Big number, I guess. 13.
Yeah, 13, right? I am Dr. Dan, rhetorician, comedian. The podcast interviews comedians. I started doing something new, David. I'm now having headliner comedians on doing material that they can't do in the real world.
Wow, that's worth checking out.
Yeah, it's like it's uncensoring the censored because they're having to self-censor because they know they'll get so much blowback that they can't do this material. So
I like it. I once proposed the Journal of Non-Publishable Research, exactly. Where instead of submitting your article, you submitted your rejection letters, and our decision to publish would be based on the quality of the rejection letters.
That's
having so many high quality rejection letters of my own, it seemed to me to be
success. Exactly, so. What we need. I still convert conservatives. Been doing more of that lately. Actually, not so much on the podcast, but I've been doing it in real life, and talk to pro influencers and rhetoricians. Also, have a new book out, 21 Coliseums of Persuasion. I lay out the software programs, all your options. You know, if you're losing in one arena, just drag people over to another one. Turns out they can't defend themselves over there, which is a good policy in persuasion. So we are back with D-Pain, and we're going to talk today about something that he told me we probably shouldn't talk about because we either will get lost in the academic tangle down the academic rabbit hole. And really, this area is so thick and so dense, like, I mean, there's massive areas of philosophy about this for centuries. And so what do we have to add? Well, we will find out. We're going to talk today about ethics, especially since part of my slogan for the Rhetoric Warriors brand is ethical only persuasion.
Ethical only persuasion. It's a good brand, though. I mean, absolutely.
Yeah. How do you?
Let's just lead with that, right? And
Well, you have to rescue rhetoric a little bit just for the general culture as a word, because they all, you know, see it as dark arts rhetoric. And I'm like, no, they're white arts rhetoric too. So
yeah, and I think that's part of the problem with the ethics of rhetoric is academically is it's all been a history of trying to satisfy Plato's probably misunderstood condemnation and, you know, in light of the ideals of objectivity and knowledge and whatever those mutated into. So trying to answer those charges rather than look at what are we doing and why and building from some other source. So I might give a different approach a try.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Like Plato sideswiped us, you know, 2,500 years ago. And that guy, like, hey, come on, relax over there, Mr. Dialectics in your cave.
Well, he just got used for so many other kinds of, I mean, let's face it, if you're talking about ethics, you're unavoidably coming up against idealism in some fashion, because the idea is what's good rather than what's bad. It's just all of the, you know, as you said, the philosophical attempts to do that start from a premise of an idealistic premise in many cases. And then there's all kinds of variations, and I'm by no means even remotely qualified in ethical philosophy. So,
but it's crazy how much does oscillate around this little word should, right?
Sure. I mean,
essentially, that's what it comes down to, is what should we do? What should we not do? And it's a hypothetical. I mean, all of ethics is, it's kind of a hypothetical on one end, but then it's completely pragmatic of judging people's actual behaviors on the other. So it has that weird highway continuum of complete abstraction and complete concreteness.
You know, our Robert Peirce-Sigs, which is really a pretty brilliant treatment in its own roundabout ways of how hard it is to ask the question, what is best? Because that's really the answer to that is what we're all seeking, right? What is the best to do?
Yeah, tell me, right? Tell me what is best, therefore I will
and
know.
How do we recognize quality is a question that drove him completely, literally insane. So, yeah.
That book, man. how long did you taught a whole course in that book, right? Didn't I take a whole course from you in that book?
I don't know, were you in that? I did that once, I think, or I don't know whether I taught a whole course in it. I used it as a lead into rhetoric it kind of made everybody crazy. But I taught chunks of it in different times, I think.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I was in that class. Like you, it was because we spent a lot of time on it, and there's so much impacted into that book that there's plenty.
It's a good read. It really is. I've often thought about revisiting some of that in light of the changes that have taken place, but it probably needs to be done.
Yeah, it's one of those books. I wonder if it actually could be made. I mean, it's been made into a movie, right?
No. Robert Redford bought the rights to that in the movie. As far as I know, it was never made. And I can imagine why. I mean, to really capture it without sullying it in so many ways.
Yeah, you would need a very particular type of filmmaker. I mean, you've got to turn that into a story. You've got to
Just finding a way to, because it's, the Chautauquas, the speeches that he, and the narrative itself and the intertwining, I think it would be extremely difficult to fashion a suitable script for that. I don't know whether everybody that might listen to this would know we're talking about Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, right? But,
was that the only book he wrote? Did Persig have other books?
No, he followed it up with one. You know, that was rejected like from over 300 publishers.
Oh, easily.
Before he found somebody to print it, and then it just sort of swept my generation. I remember sitting in Lawrence, Kansas. It was so cold in my apartment. I had to turn on the oven and sit on top of the oven reading the book. Well, 1974 or something like that. Yeah. Anyway, he did a follow-up called Lila.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And it wasn't quite as marvelous. Yeah. He tried to get the band back together, but it didn't quite.
Yeah, there's so many people that, hit the blacksmith iron one time just right. Have you watched the documentary on J.D. Salinger?
It's good.
It's great. I mean, really says, this guy that wrapped himself in mystery was really just trying to hit on young chicks.
I didn't quite get that out of it, but okay.
Write the new one, like the one that's on Netflix?
HBO or something. I saw one. On HBO. Yeah,
interesting stuff. So, all right, well, hit us with your pain system of ethics.
Oh, well, we'll see. Some of this is not original, but it occurred to me trying to think about what do we want to say. I mean, you're right, when we talked about it early in our podcast, and I said, it's just a fraught minefield of because you're either at the most simplistic, obvious levels of don't lie to people, right? Which gets you nowhere because of all the exceptions of times when, and rhetoric is by itself, fashioning the truth to make it more effective in some fashion or another. So you automatically, the basic rule bound systems of ethics seldom yield much productive about it. But it occurred to me that one way to go at this is that, the rules for rhetoric and persuasion aren't really any different than the rules for human relations generally, right? For ethics generally. How do we treat each other and what's, what's good to do? So kind of moving on that, I borrowed this trilogy from other places, but I don't, to my knowledge, know anybody's really applied it in this way, but that there are kind of three ideals operating here in human relations. One's called love, that is, or how do we regard each other, right? Wanting what is best for the other person. One is knowledge, and often the issues that we deal with surround truth, right? So we don't call knowledge or truth. And the other is authority or power. And if you think about rhetoric and how each of those things can be corruptible, ideally, they would all enhance each other, right? But each of those dimensions to human relations are easily corrupted. And in the particular case of rhetoric, almost inherently.
They have to be corrupted. You never leave things in its pristine state.
Right, because you adapt knowledge for the situation or for the audience. You have to maintain authority or exert power. How do we know whether a persuader has our best interests at heart? So those are easily corrupted, and they kind of corrupt each other in various ways. I thought about, where this gets naughty, right, is in application. And I thought about Jimmy Carter's Malay speech, where it seemed to me he came out and told the truth, we saw, wow, because that was his responsibility as an authority, right? To tell us what's good for us, being a good Christian man himself. And that sort of ended, everybody said, that's really bad leadership. And as a response, we elected Ronald Reagan, who was willing to give us the big lie, who had no authority whatsoever, but played the part in a certain kind of way, right? So
I like how Carter retreated and is like, you know what? I'm just going to build houses.
He did a lot of other good things.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
He did the Carter Foundation, as other than just building houses, but
there's a simplicity to, if I want to be a good person, I'm going to find that appeal of finding something that has a at least somewhat universal good. Although, you know, he's cutting into the real estate market, the realtors, you know.
Well, I think the idea was that these are people who would never really get into the market until the housing boom of the Bush administration. At any rate, so there is also this, you know, well, does the authority have the responsibility to deceive people for their own good? The you can't handle the truth problem. So at any rate, each of these things can be corrupted by and often are in the way that we do persuasion. We know we're not supposed to deceive each other or lie to each other, yet sometimes there are vital lies or necessary lies. Any parent knows that, right?
Yep.
Is somebody maintaining authority to for our own benefit, or are they maintaining authority? Are they doing things to maintain power? So their motives are at risk there. So that's basically it. Is that as these things tend to lean against each other, especially in the pragmatics of persuasion or rhetoric, and we can talk about leaders because those are the most obvious examples where we weigh them with ethics. But all of us have dealt with those dualities in our human relations all along, right?
Yeah, this is to me, when I look at this stuff, again, just look at the cascade of all the applications, like in your life, you know, over here trying to figure out what to do for yourself, you know, what is ethical behavior just that treats yourself well? And then you add in, you know, a partner, or you add in kids, and it just multiplies into this matrix, you know, this tic-tac-toe game of, well, what I do for you over here actually lowers my existence over here. And so then it just becomes kind of a ratio judgment, I guess, of I'm going to lower my life. Like, I moved back from LA to Austin to raise my kids because I got divorced and had them 50% of the time. And I made the judgment. I'm like, that's a better outcome for them as two human beings to have two people psychologically present than try to convince them as an abstraction that, hey, I'm in California, I'm still your dad, you come out and see me, because that abstract versus concrete behavior just seemed like a bad persuasion situation for me. I would not be able to persuade them at the depth of psychology to be able to make up for that.
Sure.
But
and with many of those decisions, the only way you would know is what are you going to be able to live with in your own, right, with yourself at the end of this, right?
So right. And well, and for society, I'm like, well, those two kids will be more psychologically healthy, and you know, for society and for themselves, and I can take the hit. Like, LA's fun, but I'll live in Austin, whatever. It's not horrible. Right. It's not Beaumont. So there's a whole set of equations, you know, these ethical equations that you run through.
Right. Well, I think so. I mean, I think all of those are problematic areas in and of themselves. I mean, you know, tons are written about, you know, just the question of love, which interestingly, in his one really useful treatment of the ethics of rhetoric, Plato focuses on love. Is it good to be persuaded by the lover who wants things from you, or to be persuaded by the dispassionate who has no interest in you? Which is better, right? And of course, that has been read as a metaphor for the difference between a noble lover, somebody who is passionate about, you know, their cause and their beliefs, or science, which is not interested in, you know, your particulars anyway. is what's ethical. So is it better to have somebody who's being objective, or is it better to have somebody who maybe have questionable or their motives are overpowering to themselves, but and maybe you.
Right.
Well, so anyway, that whole dimension, the questions of deception and withholding knowledge, and transparency are practical examples are fraught with those as well.
When it kind of gets back to
power, right? Think about in persuasion, how do you ever know whether there's coercion going on, undue power being exerted, all the way to just compliance, getting people to agree to it, even though it may or not be optimizing for them. We assume that some part of, you know, somewhere on that spectrum, almost everything is operating in leadership.
So. Yeah, and it is at all times. Like every dial on the, you know, the stereo receiver is going off at all times. And, you know, like even when you talk about, so this week, the conservative stuff I was doing this week, I appeared on a guy's podcast and he was anti-Fauci. A few of my friends from the alternative health space have become very anti-Fauci. And I'm like,
that's
okay.
Remarkable, isn't it?
What's that?
That's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah. And I'm like, okay, well, let's look at this. Okay. So here's good Fauci, right? And here's
love, knowledge, and authority right there.
Sure. And I'm like, here's bad Fauci, here's good Fauci. In between is process. Like you've got to have some kind of process for determining this, right? And so I can keep them with me. I can actually get concessions from them at the sort of meta logic level. And then I'm like, I take them through and I'm like, you have transgressed. You are not following the proper process to get to your conclusions. And I can drop that into their world a little bit and they can feel it. They can't always just immediately accept it, but it's really hard to argue against. You have no process. You have no training. You don't know logic. You don't know the stuff to make these evaluations, but it gets back to that transgression failure type thing within, if you have an ethical structure, like here's how you should vet somebody's credibility and you have not followed that, ergo, you are not ethical.
Well, yeah, it just short circuits every logical process, right? Just sort of, we need somebody to blame. Here's the face of it. And kind of frightening.
Well, that's
demonizing him for what reason? How does this become the phenomenal face of the COVID for, I don't know, however we want to typify those people.
MAGA always has to have a punching bag. It doesn't matter who it is. And so they've picked Fauci because he's not a very good politician. He doesn't really know how to defend himself.
Well, he's another case of where coming out and telling the truth. And anytime he even modulates certainty, that's an opportunity for, you know, anytime he might have not been able to represent the complexities of some of these scientific truths, but hell, we didn't even know what.
Right.
When this whole thing began, yet he had to act as authority in that acquired power, in that became corruptible from in the minds of these people. So anyway.
So if you look at your taxonomy here, your three-part taxonomy with Fauci, I mean, his transgressions, you know, they think he lies, that he has some type of motive to lie. They attach him to they attach him all the way back to Russia. And so like love, like they're taking that credibility away from him. He doesn't really care about us. He's not really trying to help.
He must have some other corrupted interest. This is not for our well-being, sure.
So he's got an ethical transgression.
Which seems to be the most tenuous of all the claims, really.
Right.
Why? The guy that spent 40 years trying to cure AIDS, yeah, he's suspect. Yeah.
And then knowledge and authority, like he's abusing his authority. He's got too much authority, too much power. Nobody's questioning him, is what their real indictment seems to be.
Well, yeah. And if you look at, I don't know if you remember the celebrity death match, claymation celebrity death match. You have Fauci versus Trump on the issue of authority. How does Trump get any authority at all? The man who would drink bleach on stage with, scientists. You're in a rather warped, inverted world here somehow as concerns these things.
Well, they can, that's what I said. Remember, one of the, my master tropes is conflation. So they conflate authority and power. Like they see a guy because he's president, because he's rich, because he's famous. They ask, they give him all the authority. And ergo, he, his statements about medical things and stuff like that are still more credible than Fauci's.
Well, and how I guess one of the more baffling to me is how do they ever come up with the bridge that he has their best interests in heart? And his wealth becomes some kind of a certification. He's got nothing to gain here, which of course misunderstands both wealthy people and his own personal wealth, but...
So when you apply, like apply your thing here, like love, knowledge, and authority, which is nice. I mean, I think any type of structure at least gives you a way to slow down and freeze ethics a little bit so that you can do so.
Sure. Well, I mean, to use your term, you know, they are necessarily conflated in any given construction, any different narrative, any different situation. They're not isolated. They do function as a kind of a trilogy, and so therefore they're if you want to consider them dimensions, which is just a convenient, not probably helpful word, but to say they really are always co-present. So yeah, they are easily conflated, and that means they're easily corrupted or put at odds with each other as a tension in any given situation as we make ethical judgments. So. What was the request? Yeah.
Well, like when you think of it this way, like I'm looking at these three, you know, kind of as a taxonomy, because I usually try to pull sure. back into if we're using this as software to
free of charge, and you heard it here first, folks.
Yeah. To do rhetoric with. So I do this, like, again, when I talk to conservatives, I do love, like, I'm just trying to get everybody to where they're capable within this public discourse, and they're prepared, and they can defend, and they can argue. Knowledge, you know, if I need to, I can go back to, hey, I have a PhD in rhetoric, ergo, you can trust me. And authority and power, I don't really do with them very much, because I'm like, I give them, if you try to take power away from them, they immediately balk at that. So like, I get this a lot. I got a friend.
Yeah, but if you're the one with the microphone, you do have implicitly authority.
Yes, but let's not point that out.
All right.
Yeah, it wouldn't work if they were running the interview.
And yes, you may be completely invitational about the whole matter and may not be trying to exert power. I mean, what is the power of talking to somebody? But once again, there are people out there who we cannot predict, who are so submissive that we can't control the power dynamic, and it can be constructed by either party, right? So let's put it this way. When you say, I want to convert conservatives, you already are making a power move. You're already assuming that you have, for their own good or for the good of humanity, going to exert power in this case. And were somebody succeed and say, wow, I was converted, then automatically the attribution that you did it. And that may not be true, right? There may not really be power wielded in these words. But that is a construct of the premise of doing rhetoric to begin with, right? That these speech acts will make a difference. So,
yeah, and it's one of the areas, again, with this duality of, you know, good behavior and bad behavior, that I'm susceptible to, like everybody else. Like, am I doing this really out of their best interest, or am I doing it out of my self-interest? And anytime you start selling anything in capitalism, you know, it gives you that flaw. So it could be, oh, you're just trying to sell books, you're just trying to sell courses. I'm like, well, you know, how much book pushing do I do as opposed to free information? Sure. And then you get into that stuff. But so would you say, like, my thing about trying to convert conservatives is ethical? Is it mixy, or is it unethical?
It may depend on your point of view.
Let's hear the Dave Payne point of view.
In practice, I think you have ethical motives. Maybe we should back up here a minute in making these kinds of, the other thing methodologically we have to know about ethics, and here I'm going to introduce a word, casuistry, right? Which is a method of reasoning that begins with cases and spins out the general principles. From
what was it again? I didn't quite hear it.
Casuistry, right?
How do you spell that?
C-A-S, right? U-I, right? That means proceeding by cases. And so casuistical reasoning, it once again fell into disrepute with the kind of philosophical ethics, but has been reclaimed by people who, you know, like Stephen Toulmin, people who try to come up with the way, informal ways that we do logical process. And so it seems to me that any approach, because of the mare's nest of some of these ethical judgments, we have to begin with individual cases and sort of say, what is best? What did, you know? Now, this is the kind of reasoning, for instance, that we do, how we use justice. I mean, the law is an elaborate system of taking individual cases and figuring out what was at odds. I mean, that's what the Supreme Court does, right? Sort of say, well, in this precedent here, these are the things that were at play, and to tries to then generate the right answer from that. Medical ethics would be a clear place that acknowledges, well, we're gonna have to cut this guy's leg off. You know, I mean, talk about love, knowledge, and authority being difficult, and will this lead to a better life than, you know, end of life ethics, for instance, have to also proceed in these ways. So you have to really ask, what in this case is the right answer? And that's uncomfortable for people, because it means there is no, like, guide, you know, answer in the back of the book or
right,
you know, logical guide. And it means that you never quit doing it. You never quit trying to reason through in any given case. So it could well be that at one moment in time, trying to convert a conservative is a self-seeking, a self-aggrandizing effort. Whereas in another case, it might be the way that you think we have to do this to save the world. So
both are good motives, though, right? Both are ethical motives.
The first case, to do it just to make yourself feel good or to get money or to be popular. No.
Oh, no. I mean, like, I thought you were
saying that would test the ethics there. Do you have their best interests at heart?
So is in a capitalist system, if you look at capitalist ethics, is wanting to make money by giving out information or service unethical? Like, we surely,
sure,
you know, becomes incredibly complicated when you start going across humanist ethics versus capitalist ethics versus all these things.
But we do that all of the time. I mean, if the monetary motive can be suspect, people will use that as a reason to dismiss. Saw this in display the other day on the news. The marketing director for Budweiser Beer is explaining how if we hit the goal of 70% adult inoculation by July 4th, we hit the president's goal, they will buy everybody in America a beer, even if you're not inoculated. Well, the journalist wouldn't quit saying, and this is a great marketing idea. This is a great, and he says,
right,
we're not concerned with that as a marketing idea. We just think this is the right thing to do. Now, who's telling the truth here? And the journalist wouldn't let up on the poor guy. Okay.
Sure.
No, you're going to make money out of this. Do you know how much money you'll make? He says, no, I think it'll probably cost us some money. And he goes, how much? And he goes, well, we don't really know, because we don't really know how many,
right,
people are going to get it. Anyway, they just went around and around about that very tension for the entire interview, overlooking all of the other aspects of.
Well, it's one of our.
You know, maybe this is a corporation, and they, and the guy was really pretty good at saying, and other companies are doing their thing, and we're just doing our part too to popularize the, you know. So.
Yeah, it's one of your most vulnerable ethical charges, money. It's very imputable.
So if buying a guy a beer.
Right.
For getting vaccinated for his own welfare and the welfare of society is highly suspect, then saying I want to convert conservatives has got to be a more difficult question.
But like, if you watch sports on the weekend, it's just endless, especially golf, because golf is high culture, high money sport. It's endless corporations talking about the wonderful things they're doing for you in the world and all their charities and all their benefits, you know. And again, it's super easy to impugn a corporation because, for one thing, corporations are our villain. You know, if you look at our movies, almost all of it, they almost all have some type of corrupted attachment to theft and profit and money. You know, it is our main villainy. So it's easy to throw that at people and make it stick. And you watch guys like try to figure out how to get out of this, like the Budweiser guys, like, well, sure, we're going to make, maybe, I don't know. Like,
it's good marketing, yeah. Okay.
Do you not know people? Do people not know Budweiser exists? I mean, you know.
Yeah. And there's a lot of other cases of this, like, you know, in transnational corporations. Nestle's has been big about moving into third world populations and helping to provide clean water. And, you know, and part of this is a response to, I think they're selling formula, which became a big ethical problem. you can kind of follow around the big corporate ethical dilemmas, you know, and find where they decide. It's even got an acronym, CSR, corporate social responsibility, right? Where they'll spend tons of money to build, this is great. Nestle's got a ton of money. And if they move into a town in rural India and dig wells for clean water and, you know, improve the lives of these individuals, but they're also, you know, planting themselves in that culture. Right. So I suppose love, knowledge, and authority are somehow combined here somehow.
Or does it go back to Plato at that point? Like, these aren't perfect ethics. Like, they're mid-range ethics. Like, yeah, you're doing this, but you're getting this. And corporations are like, yeah, that's the system. That's the best you're going to get from us. Versus Platonic ideal of, you know, complete love, which is totally not self-serving, other-centric. Right. And it's impunable because I'm just here for you. I mean, it's the Jesus, you know, sacrifice, right? I'm going to die even though I've done nothing wrong.
Well, you know, and a perfectly good answer, I suppose, is, well, if we didn't make money at it, we wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah. But, I mean, there is...
The uneasy and sometimes cooperative relationship between Jesus and capitalism is a fascinating issue.
Well, I find it fascinating watching the right use this idea of sins and failures and where you're impunable and your ethics fall apart. All they need is one little iota, one molecule, and everything else goes away. If they can make that one molecule, you know, radioactive enough.
Yeah, that's the Fauci problem. It's the Peckin Party approach to it. And that's because they're executing an agenda that overrides. And it's that agenda you have to look at. I guess that's the other dimension to these ethical judgments, is you have to look at, what's your ultimate purpose here? If we're going to ask what is best, what are you trying to accomplish here? If Budweiser were to do something that's really not good for people, only to make money, and one could question populating the entire symbolic world of sports with alcohol, is that really a good thing? And their advertising dollars have largely been spent making sure that alcohol abuse is related to any athletic event in America, right?
Yeah, oh, for sure.
And that's probably, you know, that's probably the thing they should have to answer for. But anyway.
Yeah, that's, those big sins don't really get hauled up on the carpet very often, I've noticed. Like, you have fused alcohol into our most favored cultural moment.
I guess the poster child for that problem is the way the tobacco populated the worlds of teenagers, right? Even after they knew that this was unhealthy. So,
yeah, or breakfast cereals, you know, sugar and milk co-opted children, you know, children's cartoon programming. Sure. I mean, just fusing those things together. Those are the big sins, those big ethical issues that literally they keep them out of the court, right? Like, to pull them into court to talk about these things is really difficult. And in some ways, what the Budweiser guy was experiencing. He's like, shit, he won't let me out of this you know, box here where I'm being questioned.
Right. But what seems like kind of a good thing, you know, the easy cynicism of the interviewer to me was off-putting, I guess, despite my general favor of cynicism for random and frequent cynical reading.
Well, I think that comes down, you know, that's important too. Like, I think people do have a sort of an exhaustion with ethical investigation,
right?
You know, where you're like, yes, everything can be questioned. Like, literally every single person, every single action, every single thought can be questioned for whether it's good or not. I had a long discussion with a guy. There's an app called Lunch Club where they'll hook you up for 15 minute random conversations with people all over the world. And I ended up talking to a guy in London who had a bunch of theories on comedy, and he was young, and he was basically like, hate speech, you got to keep hate speech out of comedy. And I'm like, well, now you're restricting my comedy, right? And so we basically got into an ethical discussion about what ethical obligation do comedians have to the culture? And I'm like, none. They have zero. Their whole ethic is, do I make you laugh? That if you start expanding it beyond that, you complicate comedy and you start to shut them up. So he had a very good argument on his side, and it was all good. But like, it occurred to me, like, oh, this is an ethical, the ethics of comedy argument.
Well, Tom Hanks in Punchline, the movie Punchline, where he's trying, you know, and they accuse him of being a hate monger. He says, "No, I'm a hate stylist."
Yeah. You know, gotta evade those moral charges and that cultural compunction.
And there probably is an argument to be made there that by doing it in a certain way and doing it in a comedic frame, there's something cathartic about that is diffused if you unchanneled hate into acts of violence. There's something transcendent about comedy, and I think, you know, that is an ethical case to be made.
So apply love, knowledge, and authority to that, like to a comedy, to a stand-up comic talking about a topic. Do they have an ethical obligation to think about the echoes of their words out into the culture?
Well, that's a good one, isn't it? Because it's certainly paralleled in a lot of the issues with political speech lately. You whipped this crowd up and they all had an entertaining time and went home feeling supercharged and deeply relevant and meaningful and empowered. But don't you have a responsibility for what happens as a result? And how do you link that responsibility? And hate speech is certainly kind of the contemporary struggle with all of that, right? That we want to be able to outlaw hate speech because of these consequences, our potential consequences, the same way yelling fire in a theater is not, free speech. So does comedy get a pass? Speech. Does comedy get a pass?
Yeah, and I wanted to have a pass.
Well, like I said, I think an argument can be made, because you can flip to the other side of comedy in your own work, I think, and in another student's work dealing with comedy as a political tool. Because there is, at least 35 years of political comedy in, just women as an example, certainly race as, to what extent does comedy have a role? And of course, this person wanted to make the case that, comedy is a crucial part of these movements, right, in social change. Yet at the same time, an equal and opposite case can be made that comedy makes audiences more placid about, right, more tolerant of these kinds of issues. So you encounter then the whole question of effects. And when we get into, these become even more complicated when we get outside of just political speech, where you're supposed to tell the truth, you're supposed to have others' best interests at heart, and you're supposed to, right, to yield power in ethical ways. Like our discussion of Breaking Bad, if you get into dramatic arts, are they telling a picture? Are they giving us a true picture of the world? And are there bad consequences for the distortions? That's kind of, the whole cancel culture problem right now, or at least that's one dimension of it, or certainly in cultural studies, looking at what these media depictions, how they distort the world and make us act in different ways. So all of this, so comedy would be one of those aesthetic genres where this becomes more and more complicated. I know that's the academic hell, it's more complicated. It would be nice to have an easy answer. And I think, once again, you have to go case by case. Are there cases where comedy has led to, in more identifiable ways, hatred acts? Or in general, can we sort of assess and look for evidence that it does make us, even while increasing our awareness of these kinds of issues, it does make us less likely to commit acts of violence?
Well, yeah, I think one of my techniques is, to corral the issue, to build four fences around the issue and see if I can keep everything else out. And so I explained it to this guy in London about, like, here's, let's say this is comedy and this is serious world. We have a Venn diagram here of circles that aren't touching. Like, everything I say over here, I don't want it. I don't want this over here invading my comedy. I don't want to have to deal with any of the consequences or any of that kind of stuff. But when they get moved over, like serious people, if they want to go in and pull stuff out of comedy, say something in a comedy club, somebody records it, reacts, whatever, sends it out to the serious world, and you're probably going to look bad. you're going to look pretty awful, you know, because you weren't building this for the serious, dramatic, moral, ethical world. You were like, hey, I wonder if I can get these 100 people right here to laugh at this horrible thought I have, you know? And so it's over here, it's an artistic challenge. It's literally nothing to do with cultural ramifications or anything else. But if you take it outside of that frame, it can't survive. It can't do what it does over here, out here in this world, and with any type of, you know, survivability. It's going to get crushed. And we used to talk about this in writers' rooms, that, you know, writers are just playing semantic games. It's just, can I semantically upstage you or take what you've said and twist it even farther? Mm-hmm. But it's literally a semantic game. So it has no bigger
play. Absolutely.
It has no bigger ethics than semantics in a room with six dudes usually. So, but that doesn't, people don't want to leave that frame intact. They want to come over and break open my corral, let out my cows.
Right. I think that's probably a pretty, you know, at least the seeds of a pretty good answer, which is, it is about framing, and that the conditions under which, you know, comedy occurs necessarily contain it in ways that by and large, you know, does not enter into the realm of, oh, this is a problem that must be solved right now. that some sacrifice has to be made for it. You know, and it could well be, you know, it's that there are people out there who suffers from some kind of schizophrenia who simply cannot access that frame and could be triggered, you know. Because as you note, if you start taking comedy out of that, that framework, and, you know, it's, and there are tons of examples, and we've been over many of them. If you look, you know, if you ask, gee, what kind of hero is Walter White, a meth dealer who clearly has killed 201 people? It's not so good. But it happens. It happens in a dramatistic context where if we're reading the message correctly, the comedy and the tragedy of it are kind of playing with each other in ways that increases our awareness.
So is that your ultimate, like when you think about Dave Payne, you know, academically, what are your ultimate touch points for your ethical judgments of things? Is it universal goods, like has universal benefits, or, you know, or is it like American? Like you have to locate it somewhere. Like, where's that benefit going to? Like for me, I started this little thing, Comedian Americans of America, because comedians are underrepresented politically. We're an oppressed group. Everybody wants to fire us or punch us in the face or say we're horrible people for just speaking the way the comic brain wants to speak. And so it needs to be its own little thing and have like a sub community of politics taken up for it. So what do you attach your stuff to? Like in academics, I know it's ultimately like the good of the student. Are they learning? Are they getting educated? The good of society. Are we sending out educated civilians into the society? How do you locate that stuff?
I guess the nice thing about having a legitimacy structure like the university or teaching, which is, you know, I always begin with a kind of, you know, I'm getting really tired of the answer to every problem in society. Well, we need more education. You know how tough this is, right? How little we can actually do against these stronger cultural currents. It becomes, you know, extended daycare for a group of people that we, society has no real economic use for. So why not send them to college for 4 years, get them out of your house, and they get to hang out with liberals for 4 years. And there's a certain amount of survivable social skills that will, you know, they will learn some tolerance and some discipline and maybe probably be better citizens on the other end, certainly better managers, which is, you know, kind of where all that's headed. I try to strip it down from the delusions. I guess that's the rhetorician in me, right? To get at what's really are the nuts and bolts of the set of relationships. And I guess that was, you know, when you say that the group of comedians is, are you talking about the sort of the liberal backlash against the kind of the cancel culture backlash against comedians. I'm trying to think, where else are comedians seen as bad people?
Well, what I was doing first off was like stand-ups are a kind of a really interesting little subculture of it. They're the most intensified users of comedy, and they're constantly pushing out beyond taboos and moral strictures and all that's part of the culture. But then there are everyday comedians. It's kind of what I was talking about. Like they're professional comics, but then there's a certain number of people, human beings born, that the comic just echoes in their brain. And when you work, you essentially have to quench that brain. You can't say these things out loud. I've spent most of my life whispering shit in the back of rooms.
I may be one of those, yes.
Yes, and you are too, for sure. And so the fact that we limit the comic voice like that and the comic interpretation and the comic participation in the serious world, this is part of my thing about writing the book about Revenge of the Marriage Counselor's Ex-Husband, is that I lived with somebody for 10 years who got further and further into the serious world of relationships and relational trauma while I was writing in Hollywood as a more and more comic absurd voice. And we just moved further and further apart, because those things, they became incompatible. And she devalued mine. Like it kept going up. Don't say that. Don't say that. Don't say that. You can't say that. So I think the comic doesn't get enough protection ethically about in the regular world. You can't say that. That's a transgression. Or as I used to tell people, they'd be like, hey, bring some of your comedian friends to my party. And I'm like, you don't want stand-ups together at your party with civilians.
Right.
It'll end badly. Plus alcohol, plus Budweiser.
Now, do you really want a bunch of funny people here?
Not this funny, you don't. Because I've been at parties with my friend Lawrence, and people were looking at us like, oh my God, did they just say that? Like, yeah, right. We're just kind of getting started. So that the ethics of restriction about comic behavior in regular life is kind of my point.
I guess I hadn't clearly thought about it as much. I think in terms of that, that sort of comedic interjection, and once again, I was raised as somebody who the phrase "that's uncalled for" got said to me a lot, right? So I think it is.
Well, yours is intellectual. Yours isn't always.
Well,
comic.
No, it wasn't when I was 10 years. Well, maybe a little bit, but.
But thinking about this, like you know, what normal culture allows, what normal culture wants and doesn't want, and. You have definitely have a comic frame, but you have a really hardcore intellectual frame too. And they don't want either one of those. They don't want those voices popping up.
Right. And often. And in the serious business of a lot of intellectual intercourse, they don't want the comic point of view either. So
yeah.
that's become a liability in all of those.
For sure.
I remember once that large lecture class that you TA'd in, this woman came up to me at the very end of this and she goes, you know, you're really a very funny person. It's sort of like, that's not expected, you know, and I thought, oh, that's 112 people are sitting here listening to me and only one person actually sort of knows that, right? Or somebody said, I taped your lectures and I listened to them again and that's funny. And, you know, so I was doing all this stuff, but nobody in the audience because the framework isn't there.
Right.
To lead to that interpretation.
Yeah.
I just thought it was an odd way of looking at stuff. Man. Well, at any rate, not to digress too much to your question, I think like other things, there is a kind of a savoir faire, a knowing of the right place and way to say things to get along. And when is it good to be cooperative and when is it good to diverge? When is it helpful to take things in a new and different kind of way? Or, you know, so you have to be, I think it's like any other kind of skill, only it is a skill of conversation. How close can you play it to the line that moves this from where it was to someplace you'd rather it be and still get by with it without completely derailing the group, you know, purpose here in these group situations, right? So how big of a smartass or class clown can you be where it is appreciated rather than seen as destructive? And of course, we're all negotiating that in different ways, right? There's some people in charge of the group that don't can't handle any of that at all, and some people who have a way of taking that and doing something with it. So,
well, that's why
I suspect you just instinctively, like any other kind of good communication skill, learn how to read the situation and read the audience.
That's awful. That's sort of my point. It's like you end up repressing everything. So everything's got its big tent, right? Everything's got its circus. So here we are in business, and my partner is a hardcore business guy, my marketing agency. And I did consulting before I worked for him. And I remember this one guy hired me. And like within a couple of days, he said to me, you know, you need to take my stuff more seriously. And I'm like, no, I don't. I said, the point is your stuff isn't serious. Like, it's not good enough yet for me to go, oh, this is good. Ergo, it's not earned me my allegiance. I said, what we're trying to do is build something to where it deserves the things that you keep wanting to claim for it. And he couldn't handle having a comic voice or an intellectual voice around in his business. He wanted belief. And I've run into this a lot in business. They don't want a deconstructive or a critical voice going on. They want groupthink and energy and movement.
Sure. Well, yeah, the emperor really does have no clothing, and pointing that out frequently is upsetting. So I think that's, once again, how fragile authority is wielded by those people, that they can't handle any kind of, there's a lot of control there.
But what I try to do is I rip it back to, again, almost an ethical perspective, an ethical frame. I'm like, fine, but is this how you should be doing your business? Like, is this going to get you where you want to be? Not moral goodness, but profit goodness. Is it really going to make, really great messaging that people are going to react to and then ergo buy your stuff? Or you just want people to adhere to what you consider to be standard practices or best practices and move on? So again, ethics to me is, that's why
I think so. And I think we're, there's a room for this. I mean, you began with the case of, somebody who you don't want these guys coming to your party. So you yourself accept there has to be some restriction on full out comedy all of the time, right? Not every comic insight or purpose can be exercised on every occasion. And there would be the deviant who simply is always drawing attention to themselves or countering all purposes, even though it may have a sardonic or comic element to it or in the right situation. So that would be deviant behavior. So like all other things in human relations, there's a spectrum here. But I think, your case here that there is a suppression, often a suppression, where we're trying to maintain order of the comic. And that sometimes that can be counterproductive. So absolutely, that if we can't do our business and crack a joke, I don't want to be in that business, right? However, I think a lot of people do lead these lives of quiet desperation, where there is something wrong with that, or something frightening about that, or something challenging. So I think, like all other, once again, human relations and communication enterprises, we're making it up and we're trying to, and almost nothing is completely on being. But I do think, you have a case here to make. Okay, well, if you're going to run this kind of shop, there needs to be, it's kind of like a little office Mardi Gras, right? Okay, this is a time when we parody and invert the power relationships that are so heavy here. So that might be the office party where everybody gets a little drunk, right? Or are they the times when we make fun of the boss? So
it goes back to this, right? Who sets the ethical norms here? Who sets the parameters? Because if you let me set them, it's going to be just the opposite. It's going to be 90% of the time we act like this, and then 10% we have an office party where everybody is serious and does work. I'm going to invert the whole thing. And is that value? Is that productive? All those questions, those really are not comedy questions, and they're not intellectual questions either. You and I throwing, an hour and 15 minutes every week of our lives into, a podcast because we like to intellectualize specifically about these areas. Is that, if we force that on everybody, look, everybody has to do an hour and 15 minute podcast every week in order to keep our intellectual levels.
That's right.
You know,
Well, you, I think your question was, you know, who sets the ethics? And I think that the answer always must be no one. Those are all up to negotiation. What is right, what is best is always open to speculation and criticism. So, there, you know, once again, there is no guidebook here to say this will always be the case. So it's like practicing medicine. Each individual case will require balancing certain excesses and taking advantage of whatever possibilities are there. There will be some systems of order in the workplace, in school classrooms, in our national politics that simply are completely unforgiving. We can't mock the president. We can't claim the emperor has no clothes without getting beheaded. So, you know, what's ethical in that case, neither what they do or, you know, each we have to make it up, sort of say, well, I don't know why this occurs to me. I once read this book that probably isn't very good called The Dance of Genghis Khan. And it opens up with, this guy is a Jewish guy standing on the edge of one of the trenches in Nazi Germany that they were shooting Jews into, and he was a comedian, and he shot the troopers the moon as his last act. And I don't know why I think about that, except, you know, just the pure situationalness of what can one do given the constraints on my situation here, right? But he did the ethical thing. He did the comedically ethical thing.
Right. Yeah. You don't adjust your ethics. So that's the other thing. Do you adjust your ethics across all these situations? Or do you walk around with, these are my general ethical prescriptions that I've decided. And if I were not to follow them, then I'm doing something unethical.
Right. So you asked me how I deal with these things. And I think I am kind of subversive in that way. I think that, you know, if, one must do what it takes to keep the order going, to keep the general project. You know, one has to be in a cooperative mode. But there are ways of sort of balancing these things out, and how can you subvert it and pull it in the direction you think it ought to be going? How can you, you know, back to rhetoric, how can you exert influence? And comedy is simply one of the tools of influence that you have. It's not all just, you know, self-expressive and poetic. It's also a way of getting stuff done. You have purposes with this insight. So it is a tool to get ideas out in the open that otherwise might be suppressed. So I think, you know, once again, get by with what you can and be willing to suffer the consequences of maybe not always getting that perfectly correct. But what's ethical is not going to be predictable in.
But it's not completely unpredictable either. You know, there's a mid-range on all this stuff, right? Like, you know, kind of like American ethics. Mm-hmm. There's a general, you know, a prescription of, oh yeah, that's what an American would think would be ethical.
Sure. There is a larger consensus about what the rules are. Sure. And we only, but back to the casuistry, the case by case basis, we only really know when something goes wrong, you know, and a case gets made that's an infraction was took place. And then we have to sort through that either with legal or moral and sometimes kind of medicinal, right? Was this good for everybody or this wasn't? Systems of ethics to sort of say, gee, you know, and so it's always a learning enterprise. And you're right, the comedic examples I know are almost always things that get pulled out of context and impossible to get them, put them back in. Yeah.
Well, think of it in terms of politics, because this all applies to, you know, is the right data. And this is my split. This is, I make some very strong, simple splits up front because it just gets me to where I need to be in order to be functional in this type of work about, I push for ethical only persuasion. And I will tell you where unethical persuasion is occurring and we will learn to counter it. And I locate much, much of the unethical persuasion over with the right. Like I consider that most of the right, most of conservatism, most of that kind of Trump, MAGA, you know, stuff to be unethical rhetorical technique. And people will, well, what does that mean? I'm like, okay, here's a list of what I consider to be unethical rhetorical techniques, like lying, you know, and they've like lying is a, it's a dimensional there's so many ways to lie, but let's just take that one and like, okay, so anybody that lies in public is being unethical. So there we have a public discourse ethics rule.
Sure.
And it's going to get murky and messy when we apply it. But generally, I think that's going to be a pretty strong rule that I can apply to the right. They lie.
I like it. But at the same time, the situational ethics of somebody on the other side, I mean, it is not incidental that the biggest pathological liar is seen as a kind of savior. Clearly, what they see some other kind of truth is operant here, independent of these lies, some other kind of ideal of human relations that serves them better. But you know, I guess that's just a part of the problem of ethical relativity here in how we do our business. But I would have to throw in with you. I think to sell my product du jour, the kind of rhetoric that we've been involved with. From the right, in recent years, especially, is a far greater corruption of the ideas of loving relations and regard for others, and knowledge and truth, and the wielding of authority and power. That these things are completely out of balance and out of culture with each other, and with anything I would regard as productive human relations.
So if we just took your
relations.
So if we just took your tripart structure, and we're like, okay. In order for you to talk in public, you're going to have to just pass muster on this three-part structure. Is there enough love, you know, and beneficence in what you're saying for everyone, not just for this idea of, you know, Americans that are here, you know, and immigrated early enough that they got past the wall or whatever?
Yeah, love seems kind of fluffy, but we shouldn't have to argue that in a Christian nature for whom that is the master trope. I mean, really.
Well, it's the master trope of democracy, too, really.
Right.
Equality
justice,
is love.
Or justice. Yeah. We're just, that's why justice is an ideal. But we got people laughing at the notion of social justice. So it's a tough ethical terrain out there, made more so by our mediated relations, I suppose.
Yeah, and you see a lot of people retreat over to Christian ethics and be like, you are not applying Christian ethics when you're on the right. Like conservative Jesus is not a Christian Jesus, not ethically Christian.
Yeah, not a Christian Jesus is an odd construct.
Right. Okay. Like he was like, there's no aggro, there's no money, gathering. None of that stuff exists in the Jesus version of Christianity. You know, and so you are acting like an unethical person within the Jesus universe, if you are doing these things. But making that stick, I mean, that's a different game, but you can at least say, I can indict you ethically on these behaviors, you know? And I that's what I would try to at least get to, where we can at least look up at the sky and go, oh, look, there's the ethical array and there's the unethical array. Now who's using what? If you can at least orient people to that, then they do at least take on a vocabulary for making these.
Well, it would be a nice place to stand to avoid all this whataboutism. I think the tit for tat of the whataboutism that we've discussed in many different cases. Oh, you say this is wrong over here. Well, didn't somebody do that very same thing? You know, these false equivalencies that get drawn.
Right.
I mean, some kind of higher perch from which to not get drawn into those kinds of things. And ethics would be a great place. And, you know, I think one has to begin with their sort of inner gyroscope and sort of say, you know, as most of us do, there's something that feels not right about this. Now, how do I articulate what it is that's not right about this? And then I think all of these ethical, you know, standards or ideals or rules or mores or whatever the conflated universe of moral judgment is, and that's huge. Just simply become tools from which to articulate those kinds of things. Surely it must feel wrong to some people to regard and to do the things to, say, the immigrant children that we did. really, you know.
Yeah.
And we even heard many arch conservatives at the very beginning saying, you know, this is not us. This is not what America does. This is not, you know, and that is an expression of our ethic and what feels right to do. I think one must begin with that sense of inner error and work outward from it. And maybe that is itself a, you know, and when one has to wonder about the pathology of the person who's able to withstand all of that moral judgment and discourse with a flimsy case of whataboutism. But didn't so-and-so say the same thing over here? You know, why should you have to spend hours saying, no, these aren't the same?
Right.
When, gee, is that really, you know, what's right here? What is best for us to do? Now, then let's worry about who's doing it right and who's doing it wrong. But you know, can you and I agree from this sense of what? So I guess that is the touchstone that these ideals might happen to provide for us in having some sort of conversation about these things.
Well, I find when I work with conservatives that part of the challenge is not letting them dive below the topic areas. Like if you let them dive down into subtopics and sub-evidence and things like that, they get very confused very quickly about like whataboutism and false equivalency and all that, and you're lost. But if you can keep
just cage fighting,
you don't want to do that. It's never going to work. But you can make progress if you can keep people onto something like ethics. Like, let's talk about ethics. What is right and what is wrong? How should people behave? How shouldn't they behave? So if we yank that back up to Fauci, I did this a little bit with my friend. He's like, well, he just changes his positions all the time. I'm like, well, first of all, let's talk about qualifiers because you've...
And your hero does what?
Yeah.
I'm doing my whataboutism, right?
I'm like, you've blown the whole system by saying he does this all the time, constantly. Your qualifiers are off. But secondly, I would call those mistakes. He maybe makes mistakes because these are complicated situations, new virus, yada, yada, yada. You're assigning them some type of conscious ethical transgression where I assign them a mistake. So who's right? And then you can have a discussion because again, their brains break very quickly if you let things sprawl. So ethics is a nice little corral I've found to hold things together a little bit.
Well, and once again, I think that is a way of avoiding the ethical conversation is one contradiction disqualifies you.
You're
disqualified. So we can't have that conversation. That's just a game that one plays. You know, it's the easy relativism that everybody is into of, oh, well, because we all believe different things, then I don't have to defend my values. Well, that's always been crap. But that is the easy defense. And so any acknowledgement of relativism or situated ethics or casuistry or whatever becomes a defense against, well, we don't have to have this conversation. I get, you know, I can think anything I want to. I think you're right. One has to just not go in there. And there must be some other place to go.
Well, it becomes the art of communication control. And you said it early about I'm exerting power, because if you, again, they're mistrained on what communication is, like diving off into contradiction, into tiny exceptions, all those things will destroy discussion. Like you can't make progress through a rational discussion if you're allowing those things into the process. But like, think about the filibuster and using the concept of ethics to talk about that right now, because they're essentially doing that. And I saw this today about Manchin, you know, and Simia, whatever her name is from Arizona, you know, basically blocking reform on the filibuster, the two Democrats who are actually Republicans, and saying, I don't think that the original intent of the constitutionalists was to allow one guy from West Virginia who won by 200,000 votes to control 80 million people. You know, everybody else, all these other states want it and he doesn't. And so ethically, like political ethics, he's going against political party ethics. Like part of the ethics in government right now is to vote with your party, right? And he's breaking that system and it's driving people nuts. They don't know what to do. This guy has too much power. He's not exerting enough love. And then they're like, he doesn't even know what he's doing. He's an idiot. Well, I don't know about that, but you know, if we bring him, bring that issue over into ethics, can we do good rhetorical work on it?
Well, sounds like you're making some headway. You know, it's a pretty tough one. It's a pretty tough one, I think. Clearly, there is a certain, you know, be careful what you wish for. If you change the rules here and next time around, you might be on the, you know, I personally don't have an evolved opinion about the filibuster, except it's back to kind of situated ethics. In the situation where we're divided and we must probably to survive do make decisions on moving forward, it seems really counterproductive right now. Whether that will come back to haunt us later. So,
well, but they ethically, what they do is they go and they rescue or they harvest from the worst ethical decisions ever. And so they're harvesting from civil rights, like that it was basically put there during Jim Crow to stop all civil rights, you know, progress. Or they'll go back to Nazis and they'll be like, look what the Nazis did if you took away all this. And they're looking for ethical extremes to compare their ethical situation to, so they can get, you know, some context to
sure it. Sure.
But again, it has that sense of ethics itself about should and should not frame so much of this that it becomes really rhetorically useful. And I launch into all this stuff with, hey, I don't care what you believe, I don't care where you land on belief, I just care about your process. And people seem to go, oh, okay, you know, that's an ethical place to stand,
right? Well, you know, I mean, those arguments break out along, you know, fairly generic lines. I mean, we can chart the arcs of some of these arguments. It's like the old Richard Weaver saw that, and he was a conservative, right? That conservatives argue from principle and progressives argue from circumstance. And so one kind of argument here is, you know, and that leads to these other extremes, you know, that they're going to this extreme case. Well, the principle must of the filibuster is sound because of these extreme sorts of examples. And then on the other side of the coin, well, but look at the situations that we're in and how it makes us unable to address them. So there are those kinds of, you know, contours and dynamics to these different ways of arguing across time that I think probably do ultimately have ethical postures in them somewhere. And they're not always, you know, you can't just always completely dismiss. It's a naughty field.
For sure. It is.
And it also, you know, once again, let me just remark from the sidelines that getting politics and ethics together is always difficult because of the nature of expediency and the difficulties of change. So.
Well, there you go. Like it gets naughty when you try to bring ethics in. It gets naughty when you leave ethics out.
Right.
Human behavior, naughty.
And I think that's maybe what we have to do. It's just another demand of literacy. Finding the ethical issue in these things is probably the skill that you would want to, you know, that's probably what's being muted as much as anything is not seeing these as ultimately ethical questions. And it's back to my nemesis here of saying, well, we need more education. Your job as an educator.
Yeah, you know, that seems to be, I don't know if it's the solution, but it's definitely a station on the way to solutioning, I guess. But even the sense of giving
it's a cry that we have no other solutions.
So let's try to learn something and then teach other people the thing we learned.
You know, I fundamentally think so, though, that a lot of what we're experiencing is as much an education gap as it is anything else. And,
well, I think even like just this, just a discussion about ethics as it applies to modern life and applies to rhetoric. And, you know, when you start to look through all those things, at least you start the discussion to know that it's tangled and ergo you should respect the difficulty of it somewhat and maybe learn some more about process to get you more reliable outcomes is a good thing. So I don't know.
That's free of charge here today. We have a whole new ethical construct.
That's right. Go out there and use it, people. Like love, knowledge, and authority, LKA. Very nice. Well, thanks again, man. As always, I enjoy the conversations. And we will keep going. Any final thoughts on ethics that for people out there, how to be ethical?
Well, I think, you know, once again, start with your inner sense of what's right. And
I don't know. I watched the
before. Let's hope more people have the same one.
Before Trump's speech in North Carolina this week, I watched a feed on some crazy network where they were interviewing the audience and people were, and the commentators were talking about, you know, Trump stuff. And just like, wow, their inner compass is spinning in a direction I didn't even think was possible in this country. It's just like it's pointing at, you know, all this conspiracy stuff and the things that they say are true over and over and over as if they're true. Like, wow, that is some good.
Well, it could be a limitation of one's point of view, but I'm glad you gave me the opening in talking about comedy and coping and all of these things, that the next morning the news is all about whether Trump had his pants on backwards or not, rather than anything that he said. I didn't see one headline or concern about anything that got said and its consequences. Is all just the, yeah, he's wearing his pants backwards. No, he isn't. Yeah. So I thought that's kind of a healthy move here, that this is all that we're really worried about the next day. So
I miss the days when Trump,
at least a hope for a comic response.
I miss the days when Trump was just a comic character. He was a good one. Just a business guy who, you know, overblown business guy and just the hair and everything else.
Sure. And you know, from the pics that were shared, and I'm sure, you know, the other side will say, oh, gee, it's the selectivity of your media and maybe, but the pics of it beyond the pants close-ups were just him doing his standard kind of mugging poses,
yeah,
right?
Everything. Yeah.
Which I thought, you know, wow, that's what he's really back there for is his own. And please, yes, try taking the can openers of love, knowledge, and authority and applying them to this case and see what whether it does you any good or not. Who is this for? What knowledge is there and what truth is there? And how does this exert authority or power? So,
good advice. I like it. Well, that wraps episode, what would I say, 15? And you are 13 episodes. Are we going to do another or is this the season?
Well, I guess we'll remains to be seen. I think we may take a brief break if something doesn't come up. But.
Okay, yeah. So we're just like Breaking Bad. We're going to do seasons of Rhetoric Files. But come back and see us soon. We will keep talking about this stuff. Get out there and persuade. Do it ethically. That's the better option.